The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Who is Neil Menard and what is Conversus? Welcome to the program. This is your host, Mike Consul. Let's start with an overview. Neil Menard is an executive that you're about to hear from regarding the private wealth business. He is president of distribution for Conversus, which is a Stepstone Group company. Stepstone Group, as many of you know, is a global private markets firm that provides investment and advisory services to investors and has more than $280 billion in total capital allocations, including more than $58 billion and assets under management. Conversus focuses on delivering private market services to high net worth investors. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the trends in private finance that Neil Menard is observing and that Conversus will be tracking and participating in. Prior to Conversus, Mr. Menard served as the president of CNL Securities Corporation and CNL Capital Markets, where he oversaw the firm's capital raising efforts. Before that, he was a senior vice president at Franklin Square Capital Partners, and he was also head of distribution at Steuben & Company, the provider of managed futures to broker-dealers and RIAs. And Neil Menard is also a board member for the IPA, the Institute for Portfolio Alternatives. He joined me by phone from Orlando, Florida, to talk about some of the prevailing and emerging trends in private wealth. Here is what he had to say. Conversus has been around how long? Are they fairly new to Stepstone Group?
Yeah, brand new.
Why was it created?
2019.
Till July 2019, and why was it, what is it doing? I see that you're focused on high net worth individuals, but it wasn't Stepstone focused on a lot of that same audience? Were they?
They are not. So they are, majority of their business is large institutions, sovereign wealth, endowments and foundations. So
okay.
They've historically been in the institutional business. The next, obviously progression for them would be to penetrate now the high net worth business, all in private markets, of course, and then maybe at some point in the future, even the mass affluent. As we kind of move downstream and there's a broader acceptance of private markets investments by the retail, I don't like the term retail, but by, the individual investor, high net worth investor. So.
Interesting. So what a high net worth investor is, what's the demarcation there? They have at least what in investable assets according to Conversus's definition?
Yeah, our definition. So we would say accredited investors, so $1 million in net worth exclusive of your primary residence, or anyone making, $200,000 a year filing single tax return or $300,000 filing jointly. So
let's talk about, you're obviously keeping your finger on the pulse of what's happening in private wealth. I want to talk about some of the trends going on. Now, you just mentioned mass affluent. And it's chasing that market, and everyone wants a piece of that market. And let's start there. I want to, I'm going to follow that with the nightmare scenario for a lot of these organizations that Facebook or Amazon or Google gets into the business. But let's start with kind of the hunt for the mass affluent audience. Is that one of the trends that I would imagine that's one of the trends that you're watching and that you're pursuing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a massive trend, and it's a massive trend because there are massive dollars behind the mass affluent marketplace, right? And you have an unlimited number of investors that you can target, and they're all underserved, for the most part, in kind of the private wealth space. So we are absolutely kind of tracking the private market. The issue that we see in that marketplace is how do you deliver a product properly to the mass affluent? And what I mean by that is you don't want to have kind of liquidity mismatch in a product, right? We've seen that And specifically, by the way, in the private markets where we've seen liquid alternatives being offered to the mass affluent, and frankly, they've not delivered the returns that the investors had hoped for. So that's a big problem. So how do you structure a product that allows you to invest the money properly, but kind of meet the liquidity goals and or desires of the mass affluent investor? It's very, it's a balancing act. It's very challenging.
Well, why haven't those products delivered? Is it that, are they just, in some ways, I kind of consider it antithetical to say, well, we're going to have this kind of quasi illiquid product. Are you going, are you really going to go for illiquidity? I'm trying to think, interval funds, that was the name I'm trying to think of.
Right.
Where it's not really an illiquid product, but it's not a liquid product. They're kind of splitting the difference. I'm not saying that they have performed badly. I'm just saying that there seems to be a lot of investors who are allergic to having their money tied up at all. So product sponsors are creating these vehicles or instruments they're not really liquid, but they're not illiquid. They're kind of trying to straddle the fence, and that doesn't really, maybe that's part of the problem. I don't know. What are you seeing out there? Why aren't these products delivering?
I think that's right, by the way. I think what you have is an investment product that's managing to the liquidity of the product versus managing the underlying assets, right? So, and that creates a massive cash drag on the product, pulling the returns down. So the question that we have to ask, and some of the things that we have to talk to the SEC about, are, what defines a liquid product, right? So you said it, right? Clients or investors don't like to have their money tied up. But if it's tied up for just a quarter, is that too long? Do you have to have it daily? Do you have to have the ability to withdraw daily? Because if you do, it'll be very hard to execute in the private markets with daily liquid product, right? It doesn't allow you to invest in kind of longer term strategies because of the liquidity requirements of the funds.
Well, and what's happening in the market right now? I mean, when you see, if anything, people would really value having a stable portfolio, not having all this volatility, and yet it's just not happening that way. You understand what I'm saying, Neil? That people they're in the market. It's bouncing up and down. I'm sorry, I don't know what I said that set off my iPhone. Siri came on.
She's gonna answer the question for me.
Yeah, I think she wants to get in on this interview. So. She thinks she's smarter than you with all that access to Wikipedia and all that. my point being that right now a portfolio rich in illiquid hard assets and alts would be a much nicer ride right now than the people who are panicking. And there is a lot of panic out there, people taking huge losses because they somehow think that against all historical precedent that their portfolios are going to go to zero and they're going to be homeless. It's kind of ridiculous. When you're dealing with the mass, I'm kind of jumping all over here, Neil.
That's okay.
When you're dealing with the mass affluent, you are dealing with an audience that tends to be less sophisticated, tends to require a lot more handholding. So there's that aspect to it too. How does that work? Because you want access to them, but at the same time, it's kind of like, boy, they're a lot more work than getting one big rich investor who understands things a little bit better.
Yeah, let me. There are a bunch of questions in there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the first, which is the current market environment, right? I love in these times, by the way, because I truly believe that we're heading towards kind of a U or a V shaped recovery here, and it's not going to be an L shape, right? So if you think about our good friend Warren Buffett says that the market is a relocation of wealth from the inpatient investor to the patient investor. So I love that quote because it's so true. And we're seeing that now. I've talked to friends, family, and people who just want to sell out now because they can't look at it anymore. So my advice is don't look at it. But to your question regarding the private markets is you're 100% correct, which is it's going to have lower volatility in times of high stress like this, primarily because the assets that they buy don't price on a daily basis, right? They price maybe on a monthly basis. They price on a quarterly basis, and therefore the volatility isn't as great. That said, listen, they're going to price down like everything else because, you know, private companies that are bought in these portfolios or private real estate or are going to be affected by the economic, the macroeconomic effects of a pandemic in this case. So they are going to mark down, but they're probably not going to mark down as much as the public markets because the public markets, as you know, and probably better than I, that are marked down now out of just pure panic, right, fear and our, you know, the media, no offense, by the way, but is feeding that fear. Great.
The mainstream media, not niche media like us. So,
right, exactly.
I get what you're saying.
Mainstream
absolutely.
Media, how's that?
yeah.
So then the other part of your question was, accessing these, how do you access these mass affluent investors and then how do you service them, right? So I think the answer for us is they should all have a financial advisor, right? They should have somebody that they trust that, in fact, I'm sitting in my financial advisor's office right now because he's the only guy I know that still has a landline. Find a financial advisor that you can trust who can guide you through a plan and then implement the plan with a portfolio that meets your risk tolerance and then reassess that risk tolerance over and over again. So if private market investing through, call it interval funds, through closed-end funds, whatever the mechanism is, make sure that meets your risk tolerance and frankly, hire a professional to help you get there. That would be my advice in my business, I will access the mass affluent market will be through the financial advisor.
So let's talk about that nightmare scenario I had alluded to earlier. Apple's already in the fintech business, and there is Facebook wants to start its own crypto, is starting its own cryptocurrency. I don't know what the timeline is on that. If Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple jumped in to the private wealth market with both feet, they would be, any one of them would be quite a force. When you talk about trends, I have a hard time seeing any of those, one of those companies not getting involved in private wealth. And you talk about mass affluent, they're ones who would certainly be targeting the mass affluent with their numbers there, just
right.
The number of people they can access repeatedly. How big a threat does that pose to the traditional players?
You know, it's a good question, and I think it actually does pose a threat, and I think it also creates an opportunity as well, right? So that they, so one of the things that I hope we talk about today, and I think you were going in that direction with this, is, you know, what's changed the most, and at least in my mind, is kind of the emerging technologies that are coming out every day. So we talk about fintech, Amazon getting into the business, you know, they have how many numbers of clients that they can market to, if they decide they want to be in this business. So the question I'd ask back to you is, you know, how do you see Amazon getting into this business as a product provider or as a robo/, you know, investment advisor, or both maybe, right?
I would think that they would start with robo advising for starters, just I don't think they want to get into the scaling of people where they're going to put a bunch of people. I can see eventually having kind of the phone bank sort of approach and all that. But I think, yeah, for sure, I think it's going to be kind of the set it and forget it sort of thing. And you can adjust it later, kind of the robo-advisor just using the algorithms. That's what I would imagine. What do you think?
So I think that's the answer, right? I mean, for me anyway, I think that especially in times of high stress like now, that, you know, individuals using robo-advisors are going to want advice from somebody. And whether or not an Amazon or Google or pick one can deliver the personalized advice that that people need versus the machines, I just think that, listen, they're going to be a formidable competitor. I'm not trying to be, sound naive, but I think there's always going to be a market for, the financial advisors. There's always going to be a market for the kind of the traditional investing firms. And frankly, if Amazon comes out in the robo setting, then they'll be a massive product distributor for a lot of the firms that are in the marketplace today. So, assuming that's the model that they're going to run. But I think technology, again, back to that theme, has really improved the industry, right? So not only kind of through the robo, which I think for financial advisors, by the way, having a customized or white-labeled robo-advisor allows you to serve a broader audience of clients and then can still provide that one-on-one advice model in times of high stress. And the idea of robo is not to provide the one-on-one advice model to those smaller clients, but still provide them with a service. I think you can do that. But I think the technology today that we have and the artificial intelligence, the kind of machine learning, the use of big data has all benefited the firm. It allowed them to be more kind of client-centric versus model portfolio-centric, which was what we used to be. So I think technology is going to continue to evolve. I think some big firms are going to continue to get in this business, and you have to embrace the technology, or you're going to get left behind.
So where is fintech going to go? It's going to continue to advance. Do you have any? Maybe you don't want to get into this particular area, but I'm curious whether you've got any prognostications as to, or you know of some horizon technologies that will be coming to market and just haven't been delivered yet.
I think one of the, there are, I don't even know what to call them without calling them by name, but there are technology companies out there that are making the problems that you and I were discussing earlier as far as delivering kind of private market investing to mass affluent. They're making that process more and more streamlined, right? And they're going to continue to penetrate the marketplace and grow. It's this whole ease of use is what I think fintech is doing. So whether it be for the financial advisor, whether it be for the investor, whether it be delivering, making it, the paperwork process, which has always been that kind of the holdup for the private market investing group, making all of that simpler for investors to have access, right, to gain access, efficient access to high quality product, and I think that's one of the conversations that you and I bantered back and forth via email is this whole kind of institutional investing coming down to the individual level, mm-hmm. All happening through technology, right? The ability to deliver institutional product to the individual investor has been made possible through the advent of kind of technology and streamlined delivery mechanisms. And that's really cool and really good for the investor.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Let me ask you, because what we're talking about now hints at the whole active versus passive investing, and passive investment funds were really accumulating a lot of money, while the active ones were losing out on that. And I think things have started, I think that's kind of reached its apex and things are kind of shifting back towards managed funds. Although correct me if I'm wrong, what about the whole divide or the whole passive versus active investing? A lot of the RIAs I talked to today say, well, we do both. We have a mix of both. Is that really what the future is going to look like?
I think so, right? I think there's the whole idea, so we can go back to passive investing. The first firm I ever worked for in this industry was a massive active management firm, right? And 2 miles down the road was a massive passive investing firm. And we talked about how you put the right active managers together, they can outperform the indices. Well, it never kind of worked out, right? Because of fees, frankly. So the individual, the passive investing is here to stay, frankly, you know, and it's evolved from index funds, mutual funds, to now, you know, the ETFs, obviously. And financial advisors are executing in their core of their portfolio with index funds or ETFs, passive investing, and then finding kind of alpha opportunities in kind of more esoteric active management investing, whether it be in private markets, whether it be in emerging markets, whether it be in, you know, kind of international investing. They're finding ways to generate excess return through those kind of satellite funds, if you will, that are all kind of active managed. So I think there's going to be this, you know, kind of continued, we keep talking about evolution, right? Continued evolution of you know, passive's not going away, but more and more you have to find opportunities through active management, again, to add returns, excess return to your portfolio. And I think that's critical.
Do you have any idea, Neil, what percent of people in the United States, let's just deal with the U.S., actually have a financial advisor or are invested? How big is the market of people who just, you know, they don't even think, they don't either because they're a little bit paranoid and don't trust any kind of financial advisor, or they just don't trust investments, or just are not, haven't thought it through to the degree that they've actually made a move on this? What's the opportunity there in terms of percentages? Do we have any handle on that?
I don't. I'm sorry to say I don't. I know that the total number of acquired wealth prior to about a month ago was about $17 trillion. But I think that number has come down quite a bit over the last, you know, couple of weeks. But it's still a massive opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And if you think about, we talked a little bit about the individual investor moving into kind of the institutional style investing in private markets. So the individual investor right now, and that's that kind of alpha ring, if you will, outside of their core portfolio, the individual investor has about 2% of their 2 to 5% of their portfolio in alternative investments, right? You'd think that number would be bigger at this point. It just isn't, where, you know, the institutions have 30 to 50% of their allocations in alternative investments. That's the opportunity, I think, for the wealth management business. Is in that alternative space, and by the way, we've seen it, right, in the advent of a Blackstone coming down market, of Starwood coming down market, of firms like the Partners Group and Stepstone coming down market into that space, because the opportunity set is so large, and if, you know, if you grow that 2 to 5% in alternatives to 10% in a portfolio, it's just a massive opportunity to serve the individual investor and to raise assets, obviously.
So there's the opportunity. What is the challenge with alternative investments? I suspect there's a few. We did talk about illiquidity.
I also
wanted just to throw one other dimension in. I'm wondering whether alternative investments, so a lot of these alts are too esoteric for the average investor, that if they don't understand it, they kind of got the Warren Buffett attitude of, I don't understand, I'm not investing in it. Is that part of the challenge?
That is. So a couple of things, right? The way I see this, I said, well, you know, one, they have an impression that the fees are high, right? That, you know, it's the 2 and 20 world still, and that, you know, they're paying, what, you know, 12 basis points for their ETFs. The minimums are high, right? So a lot of these accounts, the minimums are anywhere from, you know, $50,000 to $250,000. They're illiquid, and we talked about that already. An interesting point is that they're K-1 tax reporting and not 1099, which typically means that the average investor would have to file for an extension in their taxes, which nobody likes to do. And then I think the biggest is, and you said this, it's lack of information. It's, you know, lack of access to the best managers, and the feeling that, you know, when they invest in these kind of esoteric, they're really not, but private equity, for instance, or private credit, or is that there's a lack of diversification. When it's just the opposite, by the way, it's adding diversification to their portfolio. But that's been the objections that I've seen in the marketplace from investors, which is, you know, and they have a perception that, you know, because it's, you know, an alternative investment or a private market investment, that it's risky, when I'd argue it might be just the opposite. And adding it to a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, cash, and alternatives actually smooths the ride over the long term, and especially in times of high stress like now. So the major trend I'm seeing on that front, Mike, is this. So we're seeing funds now, and you mentioned a couple of the interval funds and so on. You know, so coming out with monthly and quarterly liquidity, so to kind of meet that liquidity need, right? And what's interesting, by the way, I'll give you a statistic that investors talk about having and wanting and desiring the liquidity. They also like to get paid dividends. But like 64% of them reinvest their dividends. So they don't really want the cash. They just want to know that they can have the cash.
Hmm. And that it's producing. Yeah, it's producing, and they have access to cash if they want it.
That's right. You know, but they don't really take it. They just want to know that it's there, right? So I get that, you know. There's, you know, now that like this kind of low to no lockup period, right? It's just you can have your money back either monthly or quarterly from day one. It creates comfort, I think, right? We talked about the tax reporting. You have daily and monthly pricing now for these products. Well, that makes people feel better, too. They get their statement, the thing, the product, the NAV that goes up or down, so they can actually see the movement, where in the past it got valued once a year, you know? And then, again, I talked about this earlier, but the technology has allowed for the paperwork, which is another big objection, to be made just really easy. You know, it's all done online. So, and if you think about it, you can get a mortgage. You know, you can literally DocuSign up, you know, all the paperwork for your mortgage on your phone. But until recently, you couldn't buy an investment without signing paperwork. You know, so.
So we've talked a little bit about this whole movement of institutional players moving into the private wealth space and bringing institutional-grade products to the individual. What impact is this going to have on private wealth? Because let's talk about the legacy players, the existing players that have always been on the private side. They're not at an institutional scale.
Right.
Is this going to professionalize the business beyond anything we've seen? What's your expectation as to how this is going to play out, and is there going to be a huge shakeout in the industry, or is it going to be obviously there'll be some kind of shakeout, but is it going to be much more muted than that?
No, I think we're seeing it already. I think, you know, in the traditional players, you're seeing massive consolidation, right? You know, we've seen some big transactions with Franklin Templeton and Legg Mason, right? And I think those firms will move into this private market space, and we've seen that in a traditional firm like Neuberger. I think we're starting to see that trend happen already, and I think there'll be more and more consolidation, and I think there'll be more and more firms moving into, whether through acquisition or through organic product launch, moving into the alternative investment space. So I think that's a trend that's not going away.
So we've covered quite a bit of territory, Neil, but is there another trend or two or three that you would, even a couple of sub-trends that we have not touched on?
Well, we talked about private active versus passive. We talked about kind of traditional investing and alternative investing, individual to institution. We talked about some of the technology trends and then the product trends. I'm not sure what's left, Mike.
What's your big takeaway, if just for our listeners, if you were to cite a big takeaway or two, is there something that maybe an overarching theme or two? How would you summarize it?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway for me is that as an industry, we need to provide better institutional, better alternative product to the investing public, so that they can have the same access and the same opportunities as the institutional investors have. So one of the, you know, another quote I like is, you know, we want to be able to create, and the industry needs to be able to create, take institutional advantage and create individual investor opportunity, and just kind of level the playing field. And I we're starting to see that move in the right direction. One of the other trends I would tell you about, so we talked about liquidity in private markets. This is, you know, point two, I guess, is that what we're starting to see is some of the big players in the marketplace want to create a secondary market for non-traded funds. And what I mean by that is, in fact, NASDAQ is doing this already, where you as an individual investor can go to NASDAQ private markets, list your shares on their exchange, and have a secondary market for getting out so that you can get out of your investments on a monthly basis.
How liquid is that? I mean, is it working as advertised? I've been hearing about this for a while, not necessarily NASDAQ, but just the whole secondary market. And it never seems to be as fluid as, of course, I'm not deep into it like a lot of people are, like probably you are. Is it working is it as liquid as they've advertised it to be?
It's not yet, right? It's a work in progress for sure. But I think it's an important, I think it does a couple of things that people need to think about. So the first thing it does is it allows the firms managing the funds to manage the investments rather than managing to the liquidity of the fund, right? Right. So they don't have to worry about providing quarterly tenders or quarterly liquidity because the investor will be able to put their investments on the on the auction and get their money back. So that's one advantage. The other advantage, of course, is just the greater access to liquidity for the investor. So it kind of serves both. It's not there yet, I will say. And the other challenge is, and what investors will struggle with, is the fact that nobody buys a secondary or a product on the secondary market at NAV, right? They buy it at some price below NAV. So, investors will have to weigh all of that if they decide that, you know, they're going to go in that direction. And so it'll be an interesting evolution to see how those evolve, because it's not just NASDAQ doing it. There are other firms out there doing it. And I think it's a really, really interesting trend that's developing that may broaden the access for investors into private markets, maybe more than anything else. A very interesting trend.
All right. Well, our guest has been Neil Menard. He's an executive with, in fact, he's president of distribution at Conversus. This was interesting, Neil, the walkthrough you just gave us. It's a big challenging opportunity you have in front of you. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun, and would look forward to doing it again.